have my own personal recorder. I wouldn't bother recording just yet. I have my own personal recorder, and it turns out you've got almost the same recorder, so we're recording it twice, basically. Once for me, once for you, and hopefully one of them will work. That's the idea. Good, let's begin. I'm not preaching a sermon, am I? So you don't need to turn the Bible passage just yet. I'm going to start my recorder now. Well, the theme for the weekend is the cross, but within that theme, I'm going to be talking basically about atonement. So that's the word that you need to get used to hearing. Atonement, which is spelt, interestingly, very much the way that shows where it comes from. At one meant, A-T-O-N-E-M-E-N-T, at one meant, atonement. And it refers to what Christ has done for us in relation to God. And as Marcus very helpfully just cribbed from my notes, let me say straight away that everything you need to know about atonement can be found in Charles Wesley's hymn, And Can It Be? Now, of course, being old, I assume everybody knows old things, but of course you don't know it, do you? So you need to go away and look it up. I notice we've got internet connections here, so you can all rush over to Google in And Can It Be later on and read the hymn. But I mention that to start off with because the point was made to me recently that I was becoming very complicated and people weren't understanding what I was saying. And anyway, what do you need five talks to talk about the cross for and so on? Isn't it all very simple and straightforward? So I'm saying, yes, it is simple and straightforward. Everything you need to know can be set to music. And can it be that I should gain an interest in the Saviour's blood? Died he for me who caused his pain, for me who him to death pursued, and so on. Just learn the hymn and you'll know all you need to know. And if you get lost at any point in the next few hours, you can sit there and sing it to yourself and just remind yourself where you should be. But of course, there's a lot that you could know about Christ's atonement which isn't summarised in Wesley's hymn. Indeed, otherwise you wouldn't have a Bible, would you? If all you needed was one hymn, then God would have sent Charles Wesley to write us a hymn and that would have been an end to it. There's more that you could know, and I hope by the end of these talks you'll agree that there's more that you can usefully know. One of the reasons for that is because the Christian understanding of the atonement is constantly coming in for criticism. Some of you may have heard of Steve Chalk. Any Steve Chalk ring any bells here? A few nods. Baptist minister, a broadcaster, who has recently dismissed the idea of the atonement that is held by Wesley and by most evangelicals. And so there you have to start asking yourself, well, which view is right? One of the verses, interestingly, in the version of And Can It Be that you'll find in the Methodist hymn book, this verse is missing. But thanks to the wonders of the internet, I discovered that there was this extra verse that Wesley wrote that is missed out, as I say, and it goes like this. Still the small inward voice I hear that whispers all my sins forgiven, still the atoning blood is near that quenched the wrath of hostile heaven. And it's that last bit that Chalk and many others now in the evangelical camp are questioning. Does the blood of Jesus quench the wrath of hostile heaven? So there's that problem, questions, criticisms of the atonement. But also, I would want to say that although we can accurately grasp the atonement by looking at Wesley's hymn, I'm sure Wesley would be the first to say that an accurate grasp isn't the same as a complete grasp. I mean, I have an accurate grasp of Einstein's formula that goes E equals mc squared. I wouldn't venture to say I have a complete grasp of that, but I have an accurate grasp. And so, again, the reason why you're having five talks and not a choir practice or just let's learn one hymn, although we could usefully do that, maybe we will later on, we're not doing that because we want to explore the idea of the atonement more deeply, to have both an accurate and a fuller grasp. And so that's what we're going to do. That's the agenda. So I'm saying the atonement itself is very simple. And if you do get frustrated or you do get confused, go and look up Wesley's hymn. But having said that, just because a thing is essentially simple doesn't mean that you can't develop the theme. So let's begin, and we'll begin actually with ourselves. It might seem an odd place to start, but I'm starting with ourselves, taking my cue from John Calvin. Now, many of you will have heard of Calvin. He was a 16th century pastor in Geneva, French actually, but a pastor of the church in Geneva, and one of the crucial figures of the Reformation. He wrote famously a work called The Institutes of the Christian Religion, which began as a very small pamphlet, and like Popsy, it grew. Topsy, is it? That grew. You know, so it became a two-volume mega work, as dry as dust, but well worth reading if you can get over the fact that it is as dry as dust. I often say that the difference between John Calvin and Martin Luther is nobody reads Calvin for the jokes. Luther can sometimes make you laugh, but Calvin doesn't. But he begins this huge, it is a monumental work on Christian theology, and I'd say well worth the read if you can push yourself through the style. He begins it with a surprising statement, and it is this. He says, without knowledge of ourselves, there is no knowledge of God. And that is a bit of a surprise, because Calvin has this reputation as a theologian and as a biblical theologian, as a scholar, as a pastor of the Reformation, and you would think he would say that we begin with the knowledge of God. But the Institutes begin, the first section is headed, without knowledge of ourselves, there is no knowledge of God. And he explains why that is so. He says, the knowledge of ourselves not only arouses us to seek God, but also, as it were, leads us by the hand to find him. So we begin, it's not dissimilar to old Descartes' thing, isn't it? Where do I start my thinking about thinking? I have to start with I think, therefore I am. I can only start, as it were, I can only start from where I start. And I think, in a sense, Calvin is anticipating that and saying, without knowledge of ourselves, there's no knowledge of God, because knowing ourselves, that's what arouses us to see God. That's where the knowledge of God comes from, where I start knowing anything, which is knowing myself and being led to seek God. And then, of course, it's the second section of the Institutes, not surprisingly, says, without knowledge of God, there is no knowledge of ourselves. And so Calvin constructs that a sort of virtuous circle. He says, it is certain that man never achieves a clear knowledge of himself unless he has first looked upon God's face and then descends from contemplating him to scrutinizing himself. So without knowledge of ourselves, no knowledge of God, because that leads me to seek God. But without knowledge of God, there's no knowledge of myself, because I have no clear knowledge of who I am until I've looked at God, and then from that, gone back to look at myself. So, as I say, a virtuous circle rather than a vicious circle, a virtuous circle of understanding, drawing me to know God, and by knowing God, reassessing myself. And that's the method that we're going to follow. We're going to start from where we are as human beings, and go from there to our understanding of atonement, of the reconciling work on the cross, and then back to ourselves again. Now, that word atonement, as I said at the beginning, it's spelt as it sounds, at one ment. And it's an Anglo-Saxon word, I'm proud to say, as an Anglo-Saxon. One of the very few Anglo-Saxon words that you can repeat that is our very own. And it means to unite or to make one, as the sound suggests. Obviously, it's not straight out of the Bible, because the Bible as we have it was originally written in Hebrew and in Greek and a little bit of it in Aramaic. So when you find it in the Bible, it's being used to translate other underlying words. In the Old Testament, there's a word, any of you heard of Yom Kippur, Day of Atonement? Yom, the Hebrew word for day, Kippur is the word that gives us the word that we translate atonement. So that word is the one that, if you're reading the English version and you see the word atonement, Kippur, the atonement idea there. In the New Testament, written in Greek, often used to translate a word which is actually hilasterion, that doesn't matter that that's what it is, but hilasterion, which is sometimes translated as propitiation. So it depends which Bible version you're reading. Some you'll see atonement, some you'll see propitiation. So, for example, your ESVs that you've got in front of you, if you look at Romans in chapter 3 and verse 25, Romans 3:25 in the ESV talks about Jesus as the one that God put forward as a propitiation by his blood to be received by faith. But if you've got an NIV, a New International Version, same verse, God presented him as a sacrifice of atonement through faith in his blood. So you can see some will say atone, some will say propitiate, because the underlying idea is what they're trying to get at. Now, behind even that translation, particularly in the Old Testament, is the idea of showing mercy. And so again, sometimes in translations, you'll see in relation, they had a thing in Israelite worship, want of a better word, they had a thing called the Ark of the Covenant. Any of you seen Raiders of the Lost Ark, you will know. Actually, the model they've got of the Ark in Raiders of the Lost Ark isn't bad. It's pretty close to what I think scholars think the thing would have looked like. So it's not totally unhelpful from that point of view. And it's a fun film. But the cover on the Ark was, the name of it came from this atonement word. And so in some translations, Exodus 25:17, if you're writing these down, Exodus 25:17 in the ESV, the one you've got, talks about having a mercy seat of pure gold on the ark, whilst the NIV says you'll have an atonement cover of pure gold. So you can see you're picking up the idea that behind this word atonement are ideas of showing mercy, propitiating, essentially reconciling, but at the back of it all, making one, uniting as one. So atonement is this reconciliation between God and his creation. That's the big picture. More specifically, of course, it refers to the reconciliation between God and us as human beings. So the outcome of atonement, keep it in mind all the time, is being at one with God. That's pretty accurate and helpful. But as I've said, there are conflicting views as to how that reconciliation has come about. A huge argument, even over that word propitiation. There are scholars who have argued that we shouldn't use the word propitiate, we should use the word expiate, and we'll look at why that's so much later on. But plenty of room for argument and dispute about views of the atonement. The Archbishop of Canterbury, Rowan Williams, has a view of the relationship between God and human beings, which, as far as I can see, has no room for atonement. He doesn't disagree with it, it simply is unnecessary to his whole understanding of how we stand in relation to God and vice versa. The problem with controversies, though, I find, is that, you know, it's the same always. And if you're having an argument with somebody, you get bogged down on the point of argument, and you can forget the wider picture. And when we're talking about atonement, there has been this problem through these controversies of narrowing the debate to one area, and then you miss the big picture. You miss, as we say, you miss seeing the wood for the trees. And I want to try and step back from the thing a bit, look at the fundamental principles, and then see if that helps us to understand what is actually going on in the atonement. So I'm not going to start by asking how atonement is achieved, but rather why atonement should be necessary. What is it about God, or about us, or about the world, that requires atonement at all? So that's why we're beginning with ourselves. The theology I'm going to develop, the understanding of God, is going to start with anthropology, the understanding of human beings. When we understand what we are, I want to suggest, then we'll understand better where we stand with God. And in any case, the Bible starts, well, pretty much with us, doesn't it? Begin where the Bible begins. Let's go back to Genesis. It begins with creation, and that is itself a revelation. The fact that the Bible begins in the beginning is a bit of a revelation, because when you think about it, it could have started, well, pretty much anywhere, couldn't it? There's a number of places the Bible could have chosen to begin. But it begins with what God does. It doesn't begin with what God is like. The Quran begins with a statement about what God is like. In the name of Allah, the compassionate, the merciful. It talks about the qualities of God. The Bible begins with what God does. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And you have to kind of work out what God must be like from what God has done. Now, at the climax of that creation, the work of creation, with the reading we had, is a statement which, again, I think ought to strike us as more remarkable than it often does strike us. And maybe it did strike you as remarkable because, of course, my problem is I was brought up on the Bible. I'm used to hearing this stuff. If you're not used to hearing it, the statement in Genesis 1:26 is a remarkable statement. Let's have a look at it. 1:26, God said, "Let us make man in our image, after our likeness." That is a remarkable statement. And then in verse 27, "So God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him, male and female, he created them." Now, it's remarkable enough that God should make man in his image, or say that's what he's going to do. But what is even more remarkable is that the word image that is used there is used elsewhere in the Bible to talk about idols, the kind of idols that you have in idolatry. Let me turn, you'll need to be pretty fast on your fingers with some of these, but come with me to Numbers chapter 33. I think we're all working from the same book, so it's page 170 in Numbers, one of those sections in Numbers when God is talking to Moses and through Moses to the Israelites to tell them what to do in the promised land. Numbers 33 verse 52. When you get in the promised land, "Then you shall drive out all the inhabitants of the land from before you and destroy all their figured stones and destroy all their metal images and demolish all their high places." In other words, you will strip out all the idolatry. But notice he uses the word images. And it's the image word that is used back in Genesis 1, 26, 27, where God describes what he's going to do when he makes human beings. "Let us make man in our image." Again, and I wish to goodness I'd actually written all these page numbers down rather than just the references, but 2 Kings, page 380. 2 Kings, page 380. Much later on, of course, when they're in the promised land and now talking about, of course, the problem was idolatry kept creeping back in. They were supposed to strip it out. It kept creeping back into Israelite worship. 2 Kings 11. In verse 17, we're reading about a righteous priest called Jehoiada. And it says this: "Jehoiada made a covenant between the Lord and the king and people that they should be the Lord's people, and also between the king and the people. Then all the people of the land went to the house of Baal, the false idol, and tore it down. His altars and his images they broke in pieces, and they killed Matan, the priest of Baal, before the altars." Now, the priest of Baal shouldn't have been there in the first place, of course, because they'd been told to strip out all this stuff centuries ago. But, of course, the crucial point is the images word, the thing they are to break down and destroy, is the word used back in Genesis 1, 26 and 27. So it's as though, right at the beginning of the Bible, God breaks his own rules. He's saying later on, "You will not have images of me." But at the beginning of the Bible, he says, "I'm going to make an image of me. I'm going to make man in my image." Now, the passage, interestingly, does not elaborate any further on that theme. We're told that we're made in God's image, but we're not told how. We're not told what that means. We're not given any other indication. We're not told why. Why has God done this? It's just what he's done. We are told, as you will have heard, that we're given dominion over the earth. That was in the reading. That's about it. It's only when you come to the New Testament that the implications of that image language are really worked out in full. Because it's in the New Testament that you see Jesus as the definitive image of God. You've got it there in Genesis 1, 26 and 27. But in the New Testament, we have what we call the incarnation. Christ becomes flesh, literally, incarnate. If you are eating chili con carne, it's chili with flesh. And the incarnation is the infleshing of God's Son. So let's just have a quick look. John 1, verse 14, page 1068. Just want to highlight one verse there, page 1068, John 1:14. Where John, we will look in more detail this passage later, but John 1:14. John says this: "And the Word," that is referring to God the Son, "the Word became flesh and dwelt among us. And we've seen his glory, glory as of the only Son from the Father, full of grace and truth." Now, if you think about it, there is a straight line connection from Genesis 1:26 to John 1:14. You have to have 1:26 in Genesis to get to 1:14 in John. It has got to be possible for God to be imaged in order for the Word to become flesh. So there's a straight line connection from Genesis straight through to Jesus in that sense. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. That's how Genesis 1:1 begins. And very interesting, if you look at John 1:1, in the beginning, it's identical. The Jews had their, rather like today, most Jews in the world by 200 or 300 years before Jesus was born. Most Jews couldn't speak Hebrew. They were scattered all over the Mediterranean world. Their first language was Greek in most cases. So they translated their Bible into Greek. And in the Greek Old Testament, it begins the same as John's Gospel in the beginning. So there's that straight line connection between the two. John himself is making the connection for us in case we might miss it. And of course, at the end of John's Gospel, if you just turn to the last chapter of John, John 20, last chapter but one, sorry, there is an epilogue chapter, but John 20, page 1093, when Jesus appears to Thomas, the doubting Thomas, who hadn't been there for the first resurrection appearance, and convinces him by the wounds in his hands and side that he really is risen from the dead. In John 20, verse 28, Thomas says to Jesus, what? My Lord and my God. Thomas sees that Jesus really is the Word made flesh. God present in his own creation, in the flesh. How is that possible? The groundwork is laid in Genesis 1:26. Let us make man in our image. And that image language, which is so astonishing, because it's as if God has made a very idol of himself, when you get to John 1, you see, well, of course, you must have that. How else could the Word become flesh? Unless you can have this standing before you and say, my Lord and my God. Now, with that in mind, let's then go to our second reading, which was Colossians 1. Again, when I get there, I will give you a page number. If you're a new Bible reader, the little letters by Paul come up in an order you can remember by the vowels in the English language, A, E, I, O, U, that's the order we give the vowels in, Galatians, Ephesians, Philippians, Colossians, and in a perfect world it would have been Thessalonians, but it's not, it's Thessalonians, which messes the whole thing up. But if you've got Galatians, Ephesians, Philippians and Colossians, you're four-fifths of the way there, aren't you? Nearly there. So Colossians after Galatians, Ephesians. Get it right. Philippians, Olossians, Colossians. Colossians 1:15. You should be there by now. It says there, Jesus, talking about Christ, he is the image of the invisible God. So it shouldn't surprise us, should it now, to see that there. And the word it uses, Greek word, is the word icon. Everybody knows icons, don't you? Have them all over your computer screen now. But it doesn't mean a little picture. It means an image, an icon. Jesus is the icon of what? Of the invisible God. The icon makes the thing visible. Jesus is the icon of the invisible God. But as I say, that shouldn't surprise you. Because if you and I are the image of God, because remember, Genesis 1:26 is not talking about Jesus, the outworking of it, when God makes man in his image, he makes male and female. So at least one of them is not Jesus, isn't it? The female one can't be Jesus. Not talking about Jesus there, it's talking about you and me. If we're the image of God, well, how unsurprising should it be to be able to read that Jesus is the icon of the invisible God, the image of the invisible God. No surprise that God, who can make his own image, can, as it were, enter into the role himself. Why not? Why should he not be able to do that? As it were, to walk onto his own stage in his own play, as his own character. It's what he's done. But then as you read on in this passage in Colossians, you discover there is much more to Jesus than merely being the character in whom God enters his own world. It's not, as it were, that finally, halfway through the play, God walks on. It's not that. what you find is that the one who is the image of God in creation is the one for whom and through whom God created. Look at verse 16. Paul goes on, for in by him, by Jesus, all things were created in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or dominions or rulers or all things. He's talking about the spiritual powers here, isn't he? All things were created through him and for him. He just wants to make sure that they understand that it's not just the physical world, it's that everything. Everything was created, look at the end of that verse, through him and for him. He's not a late arrival on the scene. You discover, actually, before all things were, he was, and all things are through him and for him. Now, what we have to do at this point is keep together. Have you ever seen somebody do this trick where you're trying to step out of a boat onto dry land and you haven't tethered the boat? Or the other way around. It works both ways, from the boat from the dry land to the boat. And you've actually seen the boat go in separate directions from the land and the person fall in. Have you seen I've seen somebody do that. It's very funny. It's not funny when it's you, but it's very funny when it's somebody else. We've got to hold together our Genesis and our Colossians at this point, not let them separate out. We must remember that specifically, that creation leads to incarnation. Just keep that phrase in mind. Creation leads to incarnation. I said earlier that the fact that God determines to make man in his image is the necessary preparation for the incarnation. You have to have the principle that man is God's image in order to have the actuality that the Word becomes flesh, the preparation. But now I want to say something slightly more, that creation actually leads to incarnation. The incarnation follows from the fact that creation has happened, because remember, all things are created through and for Jesus, who is the image of the invisible God. Genesis 1:26, let us make man in our image, inevitably, one day will lead to the Word became flesh and dwelt among us. The world is created through and for the Word who became flesh. That's why. It's created through and for him. And then as verses, look at the Colossians passage again, verse 17. He, Jesus, is before all things, and in him all things hold together, and he is the head of the body, the church. He is the beginning, the firstborn from the dead, that in everything he might be preeminent. For in him all the fullness of God was pleased to dwell, and through him to reconcile to himself all things, whether on earth or in heaven, making peace by the blood of his cross. Everything that Paul says in this passage applies to the human Jesus. He talks about the blood of his cross in verse 20. But what he means, obviously, is that the Christ on the cross is the Christ who is before all things and through whom all things hold together. And it is this same Christ about whom Paul says in verse 19 that in him all the fullness of God was pleased to dwell. And if you look over at verse 9 of chapter 2, just turn the page, look at verse 9 there. He emphasizes again, in him, in Christ, the whole fullness of deity dwells bodily. It is the humanity of Jesus that is part of this whole picture of God being present. The Word that is the reason for creation is the Word who is incarnate. And so that business of creation is going to lead to incarnation. Because you don't have, what I'm trying to say is, you don't have a sudden break point at which the Word becomes something different. The Word who creates is the eternal Word. And the eternality of the Word, the nature of God himself, includes all the way through this bodily aspect of what's going to happen, what's actually going to happen at a point in our history of incarnation. And that bodily aspect is important. Have a look at 2:9 again, Colossians 2:9. Paul says there, in Christ, the whole fullness of deity dwells bodily. And he uses a word, somatikos. That's the actual Greek word, somatikos. Mention that because if you look down in verse 17, same chapter, where he's talking about Sabbath. Well, let's take it from 16. Let nobody pass judgment on you in questions of food or drink or with regard to a festival or a new moon or a Sabbath. These are a shadow of the things to come, but the substance, it says here, belongs to Christ. Now, the word it used there is the word for body, soma. So somatikos, the fullness of God dwells in Christ bodily, somatikos. And then later on, Sabbaths and new moons and festivals are shadows. Jesus is the soma. He's the solid thing that casts the shadow. Now, the reason I'm making that connection is because when Paul says that the fullness of God dwells in Christ bodily, somatikos, he is not saying the fullness of God dwells in him symbolically, as an ideal, as it were, but actually, because it's the solid thing that casts the shadow. See? So the idea of somatikos, bodily, he's actually saying that the fullness of God actually dwells in Jesus. I'm not talking about Jesus was such a nice guy that it was like having God with us. That would be a similarity, a likeness of similarity. He's not saying that. He's saying the fullness of God dwells in Jesus bodily. Somatikos. It's the what you see is what you get. Presence of God. Not, here is a really nice guy who shows us what God is like. See the difference. People will talk about Jesus as being somebody who's really very close to God, and therefore you can see God through him. Paul isn't saying that. He's saying God dwells bodily in Jesus. Somatikos. Fullness of God dwells bodily in Jesus. So then, what are we saying? We are saying, at the end of things, Christ is what it is all about. Christ is what everything is about. Through him and for him all things were created. He is before all things. In him the fullness of God dwells bodily. Through him God reconciles all things to himself. You get the idea? Christ is what everything is about. But there's one little thing in this passage that you must not overlook, which is in verse 18. Look at verse 18. He is the head of the body, the church. Another body there, you'll notice, but he is the head of this body, the church. So, although Christ is unique, I hope you've got that idea by now, haven't you? Christ is unique, but Paul says Christ is not alone. The fullness of deity dwells in him bodily, somatikos, but his body, his soma, that's the word that's used there, his body is the church. Christ is unique, but Christ is not alone. He, singularly, he is the body in whom God's fullness dwells. But his body is plural. I'm looking at it. His body is the church. And as I say, that again should not surprise us, because think back to Genesis 1, 26 and 27. It's not talking about one person, it's talking about a race. Let us make man in our image. The original plan is not to make one who images God, but to make many who actually have the brilliant quality of being able to reproduce themselves. They can replicate. You only have to make two, and you can have as many as you like once you've made the two. You run out of stuff to make them out of, but you only need two to get the whole thing going. You are the living proof, and there's more of them crawling around the floor at breakfast, aren't there, under your feet. There's a multiplicity. God's plan, you see. God's plan is to have a multiplicity of self-images, beginning with Adam and Eve. Our problem is not that we cannot image God because only Christ can do that. That's not the problem. It's not that only Christ can image God. Our problem is we don't image God, whereas Christ does. There is a difference, and we'll talk about difference more later. There is a difference between Christ and us. But it's not in imaging God. Genesis 1, 26 and 27 is not a proposal that fell flat on its face. Let us make man in our image. Well, I've given it a go, but it didn't really work. Look, they're two, but they're not very good. It's a plan. It's not a plan that's fallen. It's a plan that has yet to reach its fruition. In fact, we know for certain, just come with me back to another passage in Genesis. Genesis 9, verse 6. We know for certain the plan is still going. Because if you read there, there's a warning about murder. Page 8, Genesis 9, verse 6, God says, "Whoever sheds the blood of man, by man shall his blood be shed, for God made man in his own image. So you see, the plan hasn't fallen. It's still rolling in Genesis 9. God made man in his image. Sin hasn't disqualified us from being God's image. On the contrary, our destiny is to bear God's image fully, as Christ bears that image now. And there's a hint of that in Colossians, even in chapter 2, actually. If you just go back, I'm sorry, I should have told you to keep Colossians 2 open. Just go back to Colossians 2, page 1184, Colossians 2, verse 9. In him the whole fullness of deity dwells bodily, and you have been filled in him. You have been filled. The fullness of God dwells bodily in Jesus. You have been filled in him. There's a hint there, just a hint, that there is a correspondence coming between us and Jesus. But there are other passages, and I want to just flick through those, which make the point much more strongly. Turn to Romans 8 and verse 29. We'll just reel off a few passages to look at. Romans chapter 8 verse 29, page 1138. Paul writes this: for those whom God foreknew, he also predestined to be conformed to the image of his Son, the icon of his Son, in order that he might be the firstborn among many brothers. Same word for image. Again, go to 1 Corinthians chapter 15 and verse 49, and this will be on page 1157, 1 Corinthians 15, verse 49. Sorry, it's the next page, 1158. Paul says, just as we have borne the image, the icon of the man of dust, Adam, who was made out of dust, remember, just as we've borne the image of the man of dust, we shall also bear the image of the man of heaven. The next letter, 2 Corinthians, just a few pages on, page 1162, 2 Corinthians 3, verse 18. We all, with unveiled face, beholding the glory of the Lord, are being transformed into the same image, from one degree of glory to another. If you just look down that same page, in verse 4 of chapter 4, just to remind us, where he's talking about unbelievers, in their case the God of this world has blinded the minds of the unbelievers to keep them from seeing the light of the gospel of the glory of Christ, who is the image of God. So you see, the image he's talking about in chapter 3, we're being transformed into the same image from one degree of glory to another. The image he's talking about is Christ, who is the image of God. We are being transformed into that image. Again, Colossians, if you go back to your Colossians chapter 3, verses 9 and 10. This will be page 1183, Colossians 3, verse 9. Do not lie to one another, seeing you've put off the old self with its practices and have put on the new self, which is being renewed in knowledge after the image of its creator. Genesis 1:26 again. All those passages, and there are others as well, make it clear that the intention of Genesis 1:26 has not been abandoned. We must not fall into the mistake of thinking that Christ replaces us as the image of God. That's not how it works. Christ simply precedes us. He is what we are to become. Now, the obvious problem is we are not like Christ. Don't need to argue that point, do I? And that has profound implications. Remember what it said in Colossians 1:16. Colossians 1:16 says that all things were created through and for the one who is the image of God. That's the statement there. All things were created through and for the one who is the image of God. And so, you see, creation and God's image are linked there, aren't they? If Christ is the image of God and all things are created through and for the one who is the image of God, then creation is linked to the image. But there's a weak link in the chain, isn't there? We are the weak link. Because the first image to appear in creation is not Christ, but ourselves. And you have to say to yourself, well then what happens when the image of God goes wrong? What if, instead of imaging God perfectly, what if his image actually were estranged from God and opposed to God? What if that happened? Well then, if you turn back to Romans again, Romans chapter 8, page 1138, you'll see what happens, actually 1137, the beginning of verse 19. Romans 8:19, what happens when the image goes off the rails? For the creation, Paul says there, the creation waits with eager longing for the revealing of the sons of God. Remember that being transformed into his image. For the creation was subjected to futility, not willingly, but because of him who subjected it, in hope that the creation itself will be set free from its bondage to decay and obtain the freedom of the glory of the children of God. For we know that the whole creation has been groaning together in the pains of childbirth until now, and not only the creation, but we ourselves who have the first fruits of the Spirit groan inwardly as we wait eagerly for our adoption as sons, the redemption of our bodies. Can you see the link he's making? Why is creation groaning? Why is the world the way it is? Why is it so stuffed up? Because of what's happened to the sons of God. The weak link, which is the first appeared image of God, has dragged the creation with it. God's image bearers, the sons of God that he talks about in verse 19, God's image bearers are in bondage to sin, and as a result, creation is in bondage to decay. So in other words, our present condition as sinners is not a little glitch. It's not, look, I've made this perfect world, but I've got a problem down here with the human beings. It's like the first tear, the first beginning of a ladder in your tights. And it's going to rip right the way through the whole thing. Because when the image goes wrong, and remember, creation is created for and through the image bearer. So if your prototype image bearers that appear that you put first in creation, if they've gone wrong, can you not see that the whole thing's going to be into tear? In fact, that's what Romans is saying. The whole of creation is in bondage to decay. And so atonement is not just about putting us right. No, atonement is about putting everything right. You have to do the atonement, not just to reconcile us to God, but to draw everything back to its proper place. And so let's just look again last time, and this is the end of it, Colossians 1. In Colossians 1:19, Paul says this about Christ: for in him the fullness of God was pleased to dwell, and through him to reconcile to himself human beings. No, he doesn't say that, does he? Through him to reconcile all things, whether on earth or in heaven, making peace by the blood of his cross. All things were created through him. All things are reconciled to him through the cross. When Christ dies on the cross, yes, he's reconciling us to God, of course. It's our sins he's dying for, not the sins of the bunny rabbits, you know, or the sins of whatever your computer when it crashes. Those are not sins. The sins are ours. But through dealing with that problem, he is reconciling all things to himself, including the bunny rabbits and somewhere along the line, I guess, wasps and mosquitoes and, yes, maybe Bill Gates' programs. Maybe. But you see, without the atonement between God and the image of God, nothing is right. And that's because creation was made through and for God's image bearer. And with one sole exception, the image bearers have turned against the one whose image they bear. That's what we mean when we say we're sinners. And so in the next session, we're going to look at what sin means. What does it mean when the image bearer turns against the one whose image that they bear? Now, I think that's probably quite a lot to have taken in one hit, so I'm going to stop my recorder. And we'll do questions.
Should we sing this?
That sounds